Lecture 17, An Introduction to Ethology.
Here we are again, navigating our last novel bucket, inappropriate of a metaphor though that may be. What we've been doing is first looking at how the brain produces behavior, and then looking at how a whole bunch of other disciplines would study how their discipline in turn regulates the brain. Looking at the whole issue of the evolution of behavior from the standpoint of theoretical models of evolution, looking at the molecular biology of the genes that influence the brain basis of behavior. In the last lectures, looking at the behavioral genetics approach to understanding. What we'll be doing in the next two lectures now is trying to remedy something that's run through a lot of these previous lectures. Okay, what have we been studying? We've been studying humans in some cases, but a lot of times you're obligatory, ever-reliable lab rat. And what these two lectures are premised on is a lot of studies trying to understand behavior, the biology behavior, using your good old lab rats. You're not looking at normal behavior. An animal in captivity is not behaving normally. And what this last field, this last bucket we'll be examining, the field of ethology, is premised on is the notion that if you really understand behavior, you're going to have to understand it and study it in the context of an animal's natural setting. Now, who cares about this? Why is this relevant? We already have a hint about this back to the limbic system. And just as one example, back to when the limbic system was not yet the limbic system, when it was still the rhinencephalon. Rhinencephalon, what's the deal? Why should this part of the brain be getting so many olfactory inputs? And the aha, it's not until you know what a rat is up to in its world that you realize sight and sound and touch is not as remotely as important as smell. And then as we also heard, meanwhile, if you want to understand a lot of the sensory information getting into the limbic system of an electric fish, forget smell, you're going to have to understand that what that animal cares about more than anything is electric messages. And suddenly, even to understand what sort of sensory systems are sending their projections most dominantly into the limbic system, you have to understand something about what that species is about, the natural setting of that species. Back to, again, the limbic system stimulate, as we heard, the mammillary bodies, and in one species, the rodent, the female goes and shreds the newspaper and makes a nest out of it. Meanwhile, the female primate, stimulated in the same area, attempts to suckle something, and what we have again is utterly irrational behavior unless you happen to know a lot about what that particular species is up to. And the central premise of all of ethology is two ideas. The first is the notion that every species has come up with a completely unique sense of behavioral solutions, a unique set of these designed to deal with what the environment has uniquely challenged them with, what the environment over the course of evolution has uniquely challenged them with. Every species is unique in its behaviors on a certain level. The second is the notion that if you're going to understand that uniqueness and what the behavior is about, you've got to think about the animal in its natural setting. The classic quote as to what ethology is about is, ethology is the process of interviewing an animal, but in its own language. And you're not going to understand what it's up to unless you are making the effort to understand what this language is about. Now, the history of ethology is interesting because it rose up in the mid-20th century, and it rose up definitely as a counterbalance to another very strong trend in thinking about behavior. Okay, 19th century psychology was mostly about philosophizing about abstract states of behavior and instincts and stuff like that. And early in the 20th century, there grew up this school of psychology in the United States, which was in stark contrast, in fact, reflexively sort of flinching away from earlier psychological views. This became the dominant school of psychology in the United States throughout the last century, and this was the field of behaviorism. And behaviorism is personified by not the person who founded it, that was John Watson, our guy from the very first lecture, and his quote about, give me any child and I can control the environment and I can turn the kid into anything I want, but by the most famous adherent to behaviorism, B.F. Skinner. probably the most famous psychologist of the last century, B.F. Skinner, dominating the field, and somehow in a way that I recognize is completely subjectively unscientific, this guy just typified the field. Somehow all these behaviorists were these guys in these white lab coats, and they always had these shiny foreheads with these receding hairlines, and somehow the pictures were always taken of them from sort of the rat's perspective. So you saw this big shiny forehead face sort of looming over you, the poor rat, and all of behaviorism was, you can tell what I think of the behaviorists, and all of behaviorism was premised on the notion that all you need to do to understand behavior is very simple principles. Things you get rewarded for, you're more likely to do. Things you get punished for, you're less likely to do. A world of positive reinforcement, a failure of getting the positive reinforcement, reward punishment, just control the rewards and punishments of an organism, and a la John Watson, I can turn anything into anything I want, doctor, lawyer, beggar, thief. If you can control the environment of reinforcement, you can control who the individual is going to turn out to be. And Skinner would make these famous sort of inflammatory quotes to the effects of, boy, pigeon, rat, monkey, doesn't matter. Just let me study whichever one is easiest and the rules that I derive of how behavior is shaped by reward and punishment, the rules are going to apply to all of them. And they're interchangeable. These are universal rules of behavior. And it was a very Teutonic sort of approach to thinking about behavior in terms of just a couple of rules that explains everything, and equally well for rat, boy, pigeon, monkey, this is how behavior works. Okay, meanwhile, over in Europe, sort of in the backwoods there, literally and figuratively, was emerging ethology. And ethology came out of a very different tradition. In effect, it was much more related to those 19th century parsons who would go tromping around the English countryside with their butterfly nets and collecting butterflies and wanting to get one of each kind and then mount them and just reveling in variability and just thinking variability was the greatest. Look at this species, a slightly different dot pattern than in that species. Variability was everything they were about. Emotionally, stylistically, aesthetically, completely different from a world of, I am going to figure out the two rules that explains all the behavior. What the ethologists were like the parsons stomping around out in the wild, and instead of with a butterfly net collecting butterflies because of the variance of their wing patterns, they were out collecting behaviors, wanting to understand the range of variability in the behaviors of animals out in their natural setting. And this was as different of an orientation as you could get, instead of looking for single unifying rules, just looking at the sheer variance, and with the guiding principle, you're not going to pick up that variance unless you're studying an animal in its natural setting, and unless you are making the effort to talk to it in its language. And that quote, the notion of ethology is interviewing an animal in its own language, came from one of the founders of ethology, and there were three men, Central Europeans, who did it. This was a man, Nico Tinbergen, who was a wondrous scientist, and by all reports, a wondrous human as well. And Tinbergen, one of the founders of ethology, one of the three, Tinbergen, along with the other two, started this whole field. The other, a scientist named von Frisch, and the third one, our friend from the first lecture, Konrad Lorenz, noted ethologist, cherubic bird leader, and neo-Nazi war criminal. Not neo-Nazi, Nazi war criminal. As you can see, I'm very thrilled about Lorenz and perseverate on this guy. Tinbergen, in contrast, is one of the founders, was a wondrously good guy, and among other things, was the first of the scientific community to vocally forgive Lorenz for his crimes. But I digress. Okay, so these three guys founded ethology throughout the 1930s, tromping around the woods of Europe and collecting behaviors, a variety of behaviors. And out of this came this field of ethology, and to many people's surprise, ultimately came Nobel Prizes for these three guys as the founders of the field. And what they had were very different questions than the sort of behaviorist approach of what are the fewest rules that will explain a boy, a dog, a pigeon, etc. In this case, looking at variability. And the sort of approach they would take would be to ask, what are the factors that have given rise to the unique behavioral profile of the species? And now, instead of asking it in the context of evolution and selection for this degree of sociality and this size of canines and all that sort of stuff, asking it in a very different way. first question that they would ask in their realm is one that seems mindlessly straightforward, but is anything but, what's the actual behavior? What's the behavior that's going on? And they used a term for the sort of behavior they talked about, and there was a little bit of jargon in the ethology field. They called a behavior, a particular small behavior, a fixed action pattern. And we'll come back to that term, where they got this jargon from, but a fixed action pattern, a very particular sort of piece of behavior. And where the ethological challenge came from was recognizing often you would not know what the behavior was until you could recognize that this species could vocalize in the ultrasonic range of sound, something humans couldn't hear, or that the species had some whole sensory modality you'd never heard of. All this business of it takes a lot of work and a lot of trying to understand a language of another species to begin to understand what exactly is the behavior you just observed. Not trivial. The next question they would ask was a classic Darwinian question, except we will see they asked it and answered it in very different ways than some of the other folks we've heard about. What's the adaptive value of this behavior? And this is straight into the realm of, does this have something to do with passing on more copies of your genes? You will see that the ethologists tried to answer this in very different ways than lots of the other folks out there, the scientists we previously heard about. Now, the third question they would ask is straight out of that chart of ours that's dominated this course. You remember the far right of the chart, out comes the behavior, ethological terms, out comes the fixed action pattern. And what we know is just before that is the nervous system that produced the behavior. And just before that, the framework we've been using is to ask what in the environment just triggered that nervous system to produce the behavior. And that last box is one the ethologists focused on a lot when they would say, okay, out has come this behavior, this fixed action pattern with this adaptive value, whatever it is, to now ask, what was the stimulus in the environment that triggered that behavior? What was the sound, the smell, the sight, whatever? What was the stimulus that was, the jargon that they used, the releasing stimulus for that fixed action pattern? The last question they would ask in sort of their initial sort of approach to something is another box in there, another of our buckets. Okay, concentrating on the right side of that chart, you've got your releasing stimulus, which triggers the nervous system to produce that behavior, a fixed action pattern. And ethologists, even back when they were tromping around out in the fields, and all of the ethologists were these guys who just wore hiking boots all the time, and none of them had shiny foreheads, and they were all great guys, except for that Lorenz guy, but the rest of them were swell and tromping around out there. And even then, when they were mostly just sitting out in the field with some bugs biting their calves while they're trying to study their birds or whatever, even then they were thinking about the nervous system, because they understood in between that releasing stimulus and the behavior popping out the other end, there was this nervous system that had to explain everything that went on there. The jargon they used was, what was the innate releasing mechanism? I don't know why they couldn't just say, what was the brain having to do with this? But essentially what they were asking there is, how did that releasing stimulus get turned into the behavior off the other end? And that's our first half dozen lectures or so. So those would be the big four questions they would ask. What's the behavior expressed in the most objective possible terms? What's the behavior good for? What in the environment triggered that behavior? And how did the brain turn that trigger into the behavior at the other end? Fixed action patterns, adaptive values, releasing stimulus, and the innate releasing mechanism. The last thing they would pay attention to superficially looked just like the behaviorists, but was a world of difference, which is, what does learning have to do with any of this? Okay, learning and behaviorism, you learn to do things you get rewarded for, and you learn not to do things you get punished for or that you fail to get rewarded for, and those are all the rules you need, and then you're just hanging out with Watson and Skinner, and that explains the entire world. When behaviorists talked about learning, it was to bring it down to these few simple rules. When ethologists thought about learning, it was in all sorts of different settings, and mostly what they showed, what we'll look at, are all sorts of examples of learning in animals, including we human animals, where it utterly violates the laws of behaviorism. And just as long as you function with the entire world as explained by, you behave for the good of the species in a Marlon Perkins view, and you can't begin to explain infanticide, for example, if you dwell entirely in a bucket of behaviorism and reward and punishment explains everything, you can't begin to understand some of the things the ethologists point out. One example, nothing in the world of reward and punishment will begin to explain why so many of us love people who treat us poorly, and why so often we love them even more so for that, and that's a whole realm of explaining child abuse. And child abuse making you, if anything, often more attached, explaining why something which to a behaviorist makes no sense at all makes a whole lot of sense to an ethologist. Okay, so these were the sort of approaches they would take. So let's look at them in more detail. Fixed action pattern. What is this behavior stuff about? What's this jargon? When an ethologist would use that term, at first you would think they're talking about instincts. Instincts, 19th century psychologists talking about instincts, but in a very different way, in a much more scientific way. And when you look at sort of this old school of talking about instincts, instincts covered a huge array of utterly undefined heterogeneous things. You can have an instinct for an aggression, or you can have an instinct for maternalism, or an instinct for xenophobia, or an instinct for tap dancing, or an instinct for... And this tells us nothing scientifically. What the ethologist tried to do was tame this notion of instinct and put it into a much more manageable package. And in their notion, what a fixed action pattern is about is a behavior, not all of aggression, which encompasses anything ranging from, you know, nuclear weapons to what you do with your rook in your chess game. What they were focusing on instead were fairly sort of atoms, components, building blocks of behavior, a small manageable piece of something. A facial expression, a threatening gesture on the part of a rhesus monkey. Something that involves a bunch of muscles, not just one, hit the leg and out goes your leg, not just a reflex, but something social, something behavioral in that context, but there was nevertheless a manageable piece of the behavior. The next thing that was critical was them showing that this behavior, this fixed action pattern, emerged in a pretty intact state with a minimum of learning. And here we're treading on the ice from the last lectures. Ooh, learning can occur in a fetus, that sort of stuff. But the main thing is that they were not dogmatic about it, but nonetheless, the behavior was pretty much intact the first time it was done. The critical thing, the thing that separated them from a lot of these other folks we've been hearing about, was the next observation. Even though the behavior, this fixed action pattern, was pretty much intact the first time it was done, experience would shape it further. Experience in the form of learning to do it better, and even more importantly, experience teaching you when to do it, the appropriate social context. So let's look at some examples of what would have been fixed action patterns for an ethologist. A classic one, you take squirrels, and you raise a squirrel in a lab where every day you feed it on its lab chow or whatever it is you feed squirrels there, and you expose it for the very first time to a nut, and it turns out that cracking a nut open is somewhat of a fixed action pattern for a squirrel. You take one with no prior experience, and you give it a nut, and it already has some means to break it open. It is not doing it by very slow trial, or it doesn't sit there and have to watch an adult doing it 400 times. Squirrels seem to have, as some sort of fixed action pattern, the ability to crack open a nut. Not terribly exciting, but nonetheless, sort of an impressive demonstration. A squirrel raised in isolation from nuts can kind of do it the first time out. So where does the learning come from? Where does the environmental experience? What you see is, even though a squirrel can kind of do it the first time, as it gets more exposure to it, more experience, it gets better at it. It gets faster, it gets a greater percentage of the food inside, that sort of thing. A behavior and opening up a nut is much more complex than just a knee reflex. Opening up a nut is a much more manageable behavior than aggression or xenophobia. It's a fairly concrete, sort of parameterized, demarcated behavior, which is pretty much intact the first time there, yet improves with experience. So both a hardwired, an innate, if you want, an instinctual component, but one that is still very much subject to environment. Okay, what would be another example? We heard one already. Back in the previous lecture, you take that rhesus monkey raised in social isolation, show it the face of a scary rhesus carrying out a fixed action pattern, a threatening display displaying its canines, and this monkey already has, as a fixed action pattern, somewhat of the ability to give a subordinate gesture. So where does the experience come in here, learning socially who you give that gesture to? Who you're supposed to do it to, you don't cringe in terror the first time some infant displays its not even grown in yet canines to you. You learn the appropriate social context for that fixed action pattern. It is not just some blind reflexive thing that pops out, displays some canines at some animal, and out comes its subordinate gesture. It learns the appropriate context for its fixed action pattern. Now here's an example that shows that non-human primates even understand the principles of ethology. There's a monkey in East Africa called a vervet monkey, and there's a couple of things that are very bad for vervets, like snakes or these big raptor eagle birds that snatch them up and eat them. And generally, if you were a vervet, those are the things that terrify you. And they're very different in an important way. By definition, if you're scared of a snake, get off the ground and get up into a tree. And by definition, if you're scared of an eagle that's swooping down at you, get out of that tree and get down to the ground. Two very different things. And as something that has just fascinated people who study animal communication, vervet monkeys communicate not merely about pure emotion, help, watch out. They can communicate two different words. And word is probably not a sort of an anthropomorphism in this case. They've got one vocalization for get up the tree, something scary on the ground, and they've got another vocalization for ooh, something up there, quick, get down. So these are fixed action patterns, in that young vervets can give those vocalizations fairly readily, except there's a problem, which is these are fixed action patterns rather than instincts, and suddenly you realize your adult vervet monkey understands the principles of ethology. They understand these dumb kids may not know what they're talking about. And you get some young kid who gives an alarm call, and the last thing you want is some kid who got confused saying, help, it's a snake or eagle or no, it's a snake, or not a good thing if you go in the wrong direction. When kids give off these alarm calls, nobody responds until some adult comes in and gives it as well, because they know these kids don't know what they're doing yet. They know these kids are still having their fixed action pattern shaped by experience. So that's great. What about some human examples of fixed action patterns? A few really fascinating ones. One of them is humans smile. They smile at very early ages. There's evidence that humans smile in utero as fetuses. That's what those things are called. We talked about them a lot in the last lecture. Humans smile very early on as a fixed action pattern. Why is it a fixed action pattern? There's some remarkably fancy things you're doing with your facial muscles, stuff like that. And it's there. It's a fixed action pattern. What is it we learn to do as humans, which is to activate that fixed action pattern of smiling only in certain circumstances. As you begin to learn social smiling, you begin to smile at individuals who are smiling at you or making big, exaggerated, fun faces, or you go through a stage where kids have not yet mastered the fixed action pattern, and they go and smile at mannequins in store windows and seem rather perturbed when the mannequins don't smile. They're beginning to learn what's the appropriate context for doing that. And there we have a very innate set of motor movements with your facial muscles, and then a lot of learning as to when you activate that fixed action pattern. Another great example of this in humans. And you look at musicians, and a subset of them, who other musicians always envy, have perfect pitch. They can hear a note absolutely perfectly outside of context. They know this is always an A flat, and they can hear it perfectly. And oh, everybody used to think this was a genetic trait. This was a hardwired trait. And it turns out there is a big genetic component to perfect pitch. However, unless you get music training before the first dozen years of life has gone by, even if you have perfect pitch, you are not going to be able to have it work for you. Perfect pitch needs to also meet a music environment early in life to work. This is another one of those where we have a set of behaviors that appear to be fairly hardwired. Nonetheless, they need a certain type of experience. So this is how ethologists would think about the behavior itself, and you can see nothing about this is this dogmatic behavior set in stone, instead very shaped by environment. Now, on to the second question they would ask, what's the adaptive value of a behavior? And we know exactly how some of the evolutionary biologists would think about it. Okay, if this behavior increases the number of copies of your genes you pass on, this is an adaptive trait. And if you're a male and you're mating with a female you're never going to see again, it's an adaptive thing. Adaptive is used in a very inductive sort of theoretical way. That's not what the ethologists did. They would go out and they would just do an experiment to show whether the thing made the animal pass on more copies of their genes. And Tinbergen did this one classic example. There's a bunch of gulls, bird species, where their egg has some speckle pattern on it, and the eggs would hatch, and no, the chicks would hatch, the eggs would break, and the eggs would break into these little pieces, and the outside had the speckle pattern, and the inside was pure white, and the gulls would very then carefully go about this fixed action pattern of turning all the pieces of eggshells over so that the speckled pattern was facing up. What's that about? That could produce 14 different doctoral dissertations by evolutionary biologists coming up with it. Here's what Tinbergen did. He goes and he takes some gulls who've just had chicks, and the eggshells are all around, and they've turned them over so the speckle patterns is up. And then Tinbergen shimmies over there in the grass when the gull isn't looking and turns all the eggshell fragments the other way so that the white is sticking up. And what do you know? What's the adaptive value of doing this? There's some predator bird flying around in the air, and pure white shells are just some signals saying, I've got chicks down here that are perfect for eating. You get rid of that conspicuous signal. Major adaptive value. Another example of this, and these were the classic studies that von Frisch became famous for, showing what bees are doing with each other when they're trying to communicate when there's a food source. The famed, legendary bee dance, where a bee goes and finds some food source, and it comes back to the hive, and it does this very complex dance, which turns out to have three bits of information: how far away the food is, how much there is, and what direction it is. Okay, you could come up with theoretical models. How did von Frisch show this is what it was like? He did an actual experiment, and a version of it along the lines of showing how bees know what direction it is. And in this case, he had a beehive on something like a swivel piano stool chair thingy. And he takes some bee and takes it out into a field and exposes it to some great food source, some great pollen or whatever it is that bees eat. And I'm showing here, I know as little about bees as I do about plants. But in this case, the bee then discovers this great source, comes flying back to the hive, and is in there telling everybody, you go this far in this direction. And meanwhile, there's von Frisch crawling along in the grass and reaching up and rotating the hive. And as shown in this diagram here, you've got the bee in this direction finding the food source, flying back to the hive, and while it's dancing its head off there, the hive is being rotated, and the bees all fly out in the right distance, but in the wrong direction corresponding to how many degrees of movement there was to the hive. The bee is communicating information, and that's pretty adaptive. This behavior is wildly adaptive. It tells you where you're supposed to go for your buddies in your hive to find the food. Brilliant, elegant experiments like these showing there is a reason why the gulls turn the speckled part up, and there's a reason why the bee is actually doing this dance. It's passing on very useful information. Another version of how a study like this would be done, getting at the adaptive value of the behavior of an animal. And here, you see this in a semi-naturalistic setting. You take some creature like a lizard. Everybody knows lizards are cold-blooded. In other words, if a lizard is going to regulate its body temperature, it doesn't do it through the internal mechanisms that we smug mammals can do. What it has to do instead is it moves to a different environment where it's warmer, it's colder, that sort of thing. So in this one classic study, someone had this huge, long lizard terrarium where it was this gradation of, it was like 90 degrees at this end, and it was like 105 degrees at that end, and every couple of feet it dropped a degree, and put some lizards in there, and the lizards happily sat down right where it was 98.6. And then you give the lizard a nose cold. I have no idea how you do this, but these poor lizards, as shown in the second part of the diagram, are sneezing their heads off. And the lizard has a nose cold, and what does it do? It picks up and it moves itself over in this direction, so it's now sitting in a place where it will run a temperature. Its body temperature comes up to 103 degrees. geez, you ask, I wonder why that lizard is doing that. What's the adaptive value of it crossing the terrarium and warming its body temperature when it has a cold? Okay, you're some evolutionary biologist, and you can come up with some fancy speculations about lizards. You can't regulate their temperature, leave fewer copies of their genes, blah, blah. Or you could just do an ethologist sort of experiment. You put up a barrier. You keep the lizard from moving from 98.6 up to 103, and you get your answer. The adaptation is your immune system doesn't work as well. If you can't raise your body temperature, more of the lizards die. So we begin to get a sense here of how the ethologist approached this whole study, and the whole, you know, discipline requires you to think about an animal in its world, not in your own, an animal speaking its own language. So what we've seen now is something about how they think about the behaviors of animals, the fixed action patterns, something about how they think about the adaptive value of them. What we now need to do in the next lecture is go to the next step. How do they think about what in the environment stimulates, triggers those behaviors? What sensory information causes the brain to produce those fixed action patterns? So that'll be the subject of the next lecture.
Lecture 18, Neuroethology.
Well, now that we've all had a nap, we can add to the concept in this lecture of ethology by adding on two more syllables, now switching to the notion of neuroethology, the notion of beginning to understand how the brain responds to ethological sort of signals in the world around it, releasing stimuli, and how the brain in turn produces those fixed action patterns, looking at the way in which ethologists think about the brain basis of behavior, neuroethology. Now, in order to approach that, we need to pick up one more of the building blocks of ethology. Where were we in the last lecture? Looking at how these folks, thinking about behavior, not rats in cages, not give me a boy, a dog, a rat, a pigeon, whatever, not there are only single rules for how behavior works, but instead this vast variability of animals behaving in their appropriate context, their natural setting, asking, number one, what's the behavior look like, the fixed action pattern? Number two, what's the adaptive value of the behavior? And rather than evolutionary models speculating about adaptation, actually going and doing the experiment to show what the adaptive value is. What we shift to now is that third piece that ethologists would think about. What is it in the environment that triggered that brain to produce that fixed action pattern of whatever adaptive value? What's the releasing stimulus? And it's in this realm that one needs to most definitely interview an animal in its own language. And back to our simplest version of that, which we've seen a couple of times by now, back when the limbic system was the Rhine encephalon, makes no sense until you recognize for a rat most of its language is olfactory. And you sit there and you count the number of synapses going from the ear to the limbic system, the mouth to the limbic system, the eyes, the nose. A nose has far more access to emotion in a rat. And that's a realm in which neuroethology thrives, understanding how the brain is wired up in one species dramatically different from another. Geez, wonder what that's about, because different species are paying attention to dramatically different things in the world, different releasing stimuli. So of course, the first question becomes, how do ethologists study this? And we've already seen, rather than armchair speculating, what they would do were a lot of these experiments actually out in the field sort of thing, and getting at the notion of what a releasing stimulus, what the sensory information is which triggers an animal to produce a behavior, is where they did a whole classic style of experimentation. Okay, suppose you've got some bird, and as the case with a lot of birds, there's some distinctive dot on its beak, and it's bright red, something like that. And it looked as if, in some species, this was the thing that chicks would hone in on when they would peck on mom's beak, and that would be a signal for mom to give it food, or however things worked at that point. And of course, you come up with this ethological speculation. What is triggering this pecking behavior on the part of the kid? What is triggering this fixed action pattern? What's the sensory information that triggers it? And there would immediately be the speculation that it was this spot on mom's beak. So what would you do? all sorts of experiments. First version, you get some whiteout or something and you paint over the spot there. So you've now got a mom without that spot to the kid stop pecking at it. Then you do the replacement, the substitution, the replication strategy. What you do here is, now after you've whited it out, you paint back a little red dot there and you see if the behavior starts coming back again. Okay, is it the redness of the dot? Is it the size of the dot? You put a dot that's blue, you put a dot that's checkered, you put a dot that's paisley, whatever you put on a pattern all over the beak, is it the dotness or is it simply having anything there? You see how much of the behavior you elicit, or you can give what they called a super stimulus. Instead of this little red dot, it would be this shining, huge, fluorescent red dot, and you would see if these chicks would now peck till the cows come home. You would begin to understand what are the parameters of the sensory information that would trigger this behavior. And these would be this classic sort of experiments these guys would do, and once again, actual experiments showing, well, what is it that triggers this? And it's in this realm that you would begin to see this whole universe of animals getting sensory information we haven't a clue about. We limited human primates. And what you would find out is, not only are there all sorts of different types of sensory communication, but in different species, what's the most salient type of information in the world around you can differ dramatically. So some examples. Auditory information. There's all sorts of deer species where you've got seasonal ovulation or induced ovulation. A female will ovulate if and only if there's an appropriate male around. How does she figure out there's an appropriate guy around? And it turns out it's this vocalization. The males give this calling, this bellowing thing that's heard for miles all over the woods of Minnesota or wherever this occurs, and it's the sound that triggers the ovulation. And you by now could probably construct some sort of hypothetical pathway, probably not the right one, but almost certainly a perfectly plausible one for evolution to have come up with, getting from the ears of those females to the limbic system, to the hypothalamus, to reproductive hormones, and we could begin to imagine a plausible neural circuit by which some guy bellowing across the lake makes you ovulate. So for this species, the releasing stimulus for a whole bunch of reproductive behavior is auditory. Meanwhile, there's those electric fish, and they're going about courting each other, singing in electricity. And you get species-specific, animal-specific electric songs. You get males competing with each other. And in this case, rather than the sperm competition of that prior lecture, you've got electrical competition, singing their electric songs and jamming each other's frequencies, trying to block each other's calls that way. This whole world that would make no sense at all unless you're thinking about interviewing an animal in its own language, an electric one in this case. Or, as we've heard a number of examples of, the centerpiece of our rhinencephalon, there's a gazillion species out there where the most important things in their lives are olfactory. Olfactory information, pheromones is the term we've been using at a number of points here, odorants out there in the air coming from another member of your species bringing you information. And in the world of rodents and canines, there's phenomenally subtle olfactory information, pheromonal information, telling you the gender of the other individual, their health, whether they're scared, whether they're stressed, whether they're ovulating, whether they have their testes, whether there's testosterone-derived molecules in their pheromones, whether there's estrogen-derived, all sorts of information like that. For a rodent, its world of releasing stimuli is overwhelmingly olfactory. Now, this approach also helped inform a much more subtle, much more landmark set of studies telling us about the releasing stimuli for something else. Okay, you ask what seems a mindlessly simple question about child development. Why do babies get attached to their mothers? And you're some behaviorist, and you have the answer immediately, because mom positively reinforces you. What is that mom provides for you? She provides calories, that sort of thing. Ooh, without calories, you die and you don't pass on copies of your genes. Positive reinforcement, a behaviorist viewpoint. You attach to this female, this organism who is mom, because when you're hungry, she makes the hunger go away. Great, I think I'm going to hang out around her. Perfectly obvious solution, and the behaviorist explanation that dominated throughout pediatrics in the early part of the last century. And then along came one of the most controversial scientists in all of psychology, a man named Harry Harlow, working at the University of Wisconsin, who questioned this assumption and came up with, in some ways, an ethological experiment, a classic one that winds up in every single textbook out there, asking, why is it that infants attach to mom? And this is this iconic picture that you always see. He took baby rhesus monkeys and he gave them two types of artificial mothers to choose from. One of them was made out of chicken wire, this chicken wire tube, and stuck on top was this styrofoam head that kind of looked like something with two eyes and ears and all of that. And out of that chicken wire mom's torso came the thing that every behaviorist on earth would want, which was a bottle filled with milk. Meanwhile, next to it was the other surrogate artificial mom, and in this case, not giving milk, but the chicken wire torso was covered with warm felt. And what you wound up seeing was a very surprising answer, very surprising if you're B.F. Skinner, who would be there clutching the chicken wire mom with a bottle there, but what everybody else is able to guess if they ever had a baby or if they ever were a baby at some point or other, which is you don't attach to mom because she gives you calories. You attach to mom because she makes you feel safe and warm and enveloped and all those things that chicken wire can't get you in a million years, no matter how many of your calories it provides. And what Harlow showed was an astonishing finding that seems idiotically obvious now, but this was a period where mothers would be allowed to visit their children a half hour a week when the child was hospitalized. Oh, don't worry, we feed him three times a day and even put a blanket on him now and then and pat him on the head in the process. What is appropriate child development about? It didn't include concepts like warmth and physical contact, let alone something even more scientifically obtuse like the notion of love. And Harlow absolutely revolutionized the field by showing it's got nothing to do with simple behaviorist models. It's got everything to do with different things releasing these behaviors, why it is you wind up loving an individual who's your mom. Now, all of this wound up being real important in making sense of some other findings. And these are some recent neuroethological ones, really disturbing ones on first pass. Okay, back to the amygdala. We've heard about the amygdala, oh, so many lectures ago, the amygdala, fear, anxiety, as we will see shortly, aggression. And this is imaging people's brains, one of those metabolic imagers, what part of the brain gets metabolically active, and showing people pictures, often very fast demonstration of them subliminal, faster than you could consciously see, finding a certain type of picture, which in the first studies were reporting would make the amygdala suddenly get metabolically active. And these were really unexpected, or maybe expected, but really disturbing findings. What this first spate of study showed was the amygdala would be activated when you would look at the face of somebody of a different race. Oh boy, did that stop everybody in their tracks and make them wonder what's going on? Are we looking at a hardwired, fixed action pattern of response of xenophobia, of people who are the them versus the us? All sorts of disquieting things. And what's emerged in more recent years is a more subtle literature showing that doesn't happen all the time. And straight out of our world of fixed action patterns, it depends on who the face is. Celebrity faces don't evoke that, but it also depends on who you are and how it's framed. And there's some remarkably subtle psychological tests that can get at somebody's sort of innate levels, innate, that's the wrong word to use, but implicit levels of racism, how much they distinguish traits of people based on race. And the higher they score on that sort of scale, the more their amygdala activates. But in a brilliant study that was done by some psychologists at Princeton, primarily someone named Susan Fiske, showing if you frame the setting, if you frame the way the person looks at the face, if you make them think about the person as an individual beforehand with some extremely subtle questions having nothing to do with race, if you force them to think about them as an individual, the amygdala doesn't light up anymore. So what initially looked like a very disturbing bit of, uh-oh, our brains may simply not be all that thrilled about people who look different than us, what you suddenly have instead is, it depends on the context, it depends on experience, depends on, we are not looking at any sort of neuroethological inevitability. Okay, so that sets us up now for looking more at how the ethologist would think about the brain. as they called it, as you heard in the last lecture, an innate releasing mechanism. And that used to be this utterly mysterious piece. You got the releasing stimulus, something out in the sensory world, and the behavior pops out the other end. And something has to happen in between, and that's that brain stuff and all the people with the lab coats, and we don't go anywhere near it. And in recent decades, instead, the study of brain function in an ethological setting, neuroethology, has become the hottest topic out there. And what those studies have shown, in some cases, some remarkably detailed, obsessively tenacious research has shown exactly what the circuitry is, how this happens. For example, there's bird species where every year during the mating season, they learn a new song. And there are scientists who by now can show you a circuitry map, like you can get down at the, the hardware store showing how to wire up your, whatever it is you wire up at home, and I know nothing about hardware either, but you can get one of these circuitry maps, and by now, the people who study these bird systems here, they can show you exactly which pathways in the brain do what under the control of which hormones, which do what to the excitability of which axon hillocks, and all that stuff out of those earlier lectures. It's completely understood. In the same way, many lectures back, we heard about the lordosis reflex in female rodents, where if and only if estrogen levels are high enough, you get this reflex of arching the back when pressed on the flank. And that one has been charted out with a whole neuroethological map as well, people knowing exactly the wiring of that. A very interesting recent one has been sorted out with humans and with rodents as well, and this is back to the amygdala. And I'm focusing a lot on the amygdala here because this is a prelude to the coming lectures looking at aggression and looking at the roles of fear and anxiety in aggression, and you better bet we're coming back to the amygdala big time. Okay, so you got the amygdala, and we have this paradigm already. Stick a person in a brain scanner, and you see the sort of circumstances that make the amygdala become excitable, and you look at someone who's been through a trauma, someone with post-traumatic stress disorder. And what we've seen already is, for the same stimulus, for the same frightening stimulus, even for the same frightening subliminal stimulus, you're not even consciously aware of what you've seen. It's been flashed up for a 16th of a second. Your cortex doesn't know what it's seen. Your amygdala knows. And in individuals with PTSD, what you get is an amygdala that lights up more readily, and once it's up, it stays active longer. You have a hyper-responsive amygdala, and suddenly, out the other end, you've got a heart racing, things like that. What people now understand, and that we'll come to review in subsequent lectures, is what exactly is it about stress? How do stress hormones on a cellular level, soon on a genetic level, how do they make the amygdala become more excitable for the rest of time? And we are close to constructing a circuitry map for that. What sensory information? Okay, you had some trauma with a person with a certain accent, a certain whatever, and umpteen years later, you're not even consciously aware there's a voice with a similar accent back there, and you don't even know why it is your heart is racing. Your amygdala knows, and more we understand the circuitry by which it taps into a certain sensory memory, and you've got this hyper-excitable amygdala, and off it runs. So this is a very vibrant area of research explaining how you get from information in the outside world to behavior, or the physiology that underlines behavior, what the brain is doing in between. Okay, now this sets us up for looking at, in lots of ways, the most subtle realm of ethology when these guys would start to think about learning, how things would change with repeated experience. And learning, obviously, was something the behaviorists focused on. All you need to do to explain behavior is figure out what has been learned that brings about positive reinforcement versus negative, the world of reward, punishment, all that sort of thing. However, ethologists thought about it in a very different way. And the single best way of showing that the behaviorist viewpoint of how things work, how learning occurs, can't apply in all cases to animals in their natural setting, and the simple fact is discussed in the last lecture, whether you were studying experimental animals being subjected to stress, pets being abused, or those of us in bad relationships who persist in the world of abused women who leave the shelter and go back to him, even though everyone is saying this is going to happen again and is going to be worse. Why do we love individuals who treat us poorly? Why in the world of being negatively reinforced for a certain type of attachment doesn't the attachment go away? why doesn't that happen? And behaviorism is at a loss to explain it, and ethologists are ones to show the classic behaviorist rules of learning don't apply in lots of circumstances. Now, some of the time what ethologists would focus on would be classical types of learning. And what they would show is when they occurred in untraditional settings, they could be very interesting. One example of this. Okay, what's one of the great instincts out there if you ask people about instinctual behaviors? And one of the ones that immediately gets summoned is a maternal instinct, and mothers just know instinctually how to take care of their kids, and this is hardwired. This does not involve learning. And what was shown by ethologists is it involves learning in all sorts of species, including non-human ones. For example, you look at baboons. Female baboons, what's the old view? You've just given birth to your first child, and you just instinctually know what to do. And this turns out not to be the case at all. Baboon females have to learn to be mothers. And what you wind up seeing is the more kids you've had, the greater the likelihood of the kids surviving. And even more interestingly, if you had an older sister and you got the chance to do babysitting, anting behavior for the kids, if you got experience with infants before you had your own, your first child is more likely to survive than a female who's had a first kid without an older sister to have practiced on. It's not an instinct, it's something you learn. And this is a realm where people would have pulled out instinct as a instinctual reflex or something, as an explanatory mechanism. Oh, females just know how to be maternal. That's sure not the case for baboon mothers. This is a realm where trial and error learning apply to animal behavior, very unexpected. Now, there were realms, in addition, where all sorts of learning would go on that utterly violated the notion of what behaviorist rules of learning is about. And one of them is probably the most famous phenomenon to come out of ethology, and this is one that Lorenz came up with and that he's most famous for, this whole notion, if you are a newborn duck, if you are a baby duck, how do you decide who mom is? Well, you could do it by behaviorist learning and trial and error and sort of thing, and this large creature that turns out to be a tree you thought was mom, and when you're really getting hungry, you decide by trial and error that's not mom after all, and this large predatory cat may look like mom, and that doesn't work out so well after you're predated. No, you don't see trial and error learning. Instead, what you see is what the ethologists called imprinting. And this is very different from those imprinted genes we heard about back when in another lecture. Imprinting, somewhere shortly after birth, there's this critical period, this time window, where these newborn birds have a rule. Anything that's big and moving around and hovering over me, I am going to imprint on. I am going to consider to be mom. And in the most famous sort of scene out of all of ethology, you would have Lorenz imprinting all these little baby duckies who would follow him around as he was goose-stepping across a field there. And that sort of stuff you would wind up seeing. This is not by trial and error. This is a completely different type of learning, one that the neuroethologists have not really sorted out much yet. What's going on so that you have this critical period in a nervous system where whoever's big and moving and looming over you, you learn unstoppably for the rest of time that that is mom at that point. This is a completely different type of learning, one with no ready explanation if the world consists of trial and error. Instead, you have a nervous system that is simply wired up to do this one trial learning. Now, another realm of learning that the ethologist focused on is something that they term prepared learning. And this is a really interesting concept. It's the notion that you can get behaviors that emerge out there and are subject to learning, to experience all of that, but certain versions of the behaviors are learned more easily than others. You are prepared to learn certain types of things more readily than others. Here's one example of this. And this one has been studied like crazy. It's back to those birds that learn their bird song. And it turns out different birds have different bird songs, different bird species do. Different populations of the same species have different versions of their songs. Dialects has been used appropriately to describe this. So how do you learn the bird song of your own species and your own neighborhood or often your own family? Okay, trial and error. If you don't learn the right bird song, nobody mates with you. Who knows what? Something like that. But what the ethologists have shown is there's prepared learning. What do I mean by this? You are sitting there, and you are this bird, and you are being exposed to the song from your species and population. And with the same frequency, the same volume, the same everything, you're being exposed to the song of some other bird, even a species that's not far from yours, and for the same sensory input, the same severity, the same magnitude of releasing stimuli, the same experience at learning, these birds are wired up to preferentially learn their own song. They don't sing that song without experience. This is not an innate, instinctual thing. You got to learn your song. Nonetheless, there's some sort of wiring in there for prepared learning. You are more likely to learn the one of your own. There's some sort of predisposition there. And the ethologist proceeded to show there's all sorts of realms of prepared learning. Another example of this. Monkeys. One of the great sort of myths about monkeys is that a monkey who has been sort of born of monkeys in a laboratory setting for 4,000 generations nonetheless is instinctually terrified of snakes. That's not the case. But there's prepared learning. For the same aversive exposure, a monkey more readily learns an aversion to snakes than some random other object. For the same yoking, for example, to a punishment, it makes the association of bad things with snaky-shaped things more readily than with other stuff. There is prepared learning for yoking the experience of the snake to bad things. Now, here's another example of this, and this is one shown in humans, and it is called the Sauce-Bernays syndrome, and almost certainly is pronounced differently if you actually know how to speak French, but we'll call it the Sauce-Bernays syndrome for the moment, based on Sauce-Bernays, a type of French food, which, oddly enough, is central to this example, and this was an example outlined by a psychologist, Martin Seligman, based on his own personal experience. He went out for dinner one evening at 6 o'clock, he had dinner, and it happened to be French food, sauce bernaise, and in his carefully controlled study, he ate dinner from 6 o'clock till 7 o'clock exactly. Then he stretched or did something or other or studied science for the next hour, and then at 8 o'clock, he started listening to an opera, and the opera being a Wagner opera went on interminably until midnight or so, and then at 1 in the morning, he started getting queasy because he was having a stomach problem. He started feeling not well. Okay, so you are a behaviorist, and you are asking, what associations do you learn? You learn the ones that are most recent. You associate some outcome with what happened most recently to you. Ooh, I pick up this item and I get a shock. What caused me to get that shock? Is it picking up this item, or is it something I did 4.5 hours ago? No, this is a much more logical association you make. So you're sitting there at 1 in the morning feeling queasy and awful. What was the strongest sensory information you got recently? Well, let's see. I was listening to some very marked auditory information, music, up to an hour ago, whereas it was, 6 hours ago that I finished that dinner. By all logic, the next time I find myself in a Wagnerian opera, I should feel queasy. But that's not what happens. What you find instead is the next time you sit down with that food, you feel queasy. And there you have the prepared learning. Your stomach feels bad. Do you have the equal likelihood of associating that bad stomach feeling with a certain sight, with a certain sound, with a certain tactile stimulus, or a certain taste? We have prepared learning to go in the direction of associating taste with stomach outcomes. So that's a bit of our wiring. Another interesting example of that is found in human babies. There is a point where kids under a year old are just acquiring language, and what you find is that you can teach kids to recognize certain sounds. We saw already how you can show that a child, even a child who can't speak yet, can tell you they recognize something as familiar. Novel things make their heart speed up faster. You can tell if a child has learned a particular sound. And an infant can learn sounds, syllables from any language on earth. As we get older, we get worse and worse at doing that for languages other than our own. But a 6-month-old can learn the sound from any given language on earth, and they can learn all sorts of other sounds as well. But what you see is we humans have prepared learning. An infant is far better at learning a sound that comes from a human language than a sound from some other source. For the same intensity of input, we are wired up in some ways to be predisposed to learn the sounds of language. Not any particular language, but language-ness. We have brains that are well set for that. Okay, so this begins to give us a sense of how ethologists think about things and how neuroethologists have begun to give us tremendous insights. You can't understand the brain and how it works without understanding the special evolutionary setting, the special ecological setting, the special solutions, the special language of behavior that that species has come up with. You need that to understand the brain. Now, what we've also gotten to now is completing our last separate bucket. We've looked a whole lot at the nervous system, what produced that behavior that occurred 2 seconds later, and we have now examined separate disciplinary approaches, beginning with the evolution of these genes relevant to behavior, the molecular biology, that fetal life, early experience, all the way up to the smell, the sound, the electric sonnet, the electric lullaby that you heard 1 second before the behavior. We are now equipped with a whole bunch of these different disciplines. And what we'll now be doing in the rest of this course is applying it, seeing how you begin to integrate thinking about all these different disciplines in thinking about a realm of human behavior. And amid the ones that could have been chosen, parental behavior, sexual behavior, communication, whatever, what we'll be focusing on is one of the most fascinating, one of the most interesting, one of the ones that most calls upon us to integrate these different approaches and their interactions, and one that I believe is overwhelmingly the most important topic in behavioral biology for us to master, understanding the biology of why some of us are so appallingly damaging to other humans. What's the biology of human aggression? So armed with our tools now, our various disciplines, and far more importantly, a sense of the limits, the assumptions, the confounds of each discipline, and how they intertwine with each other, we will now begin to look at the biology of violence, and embedded in that, some good news, the biology of cooperation.